everyone, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Wiser. I'm Shannon Sue, a current third-year medical student and VP of Wiser at Emory University School of Medicine. I'm joined today by Megan Wasson.
Hi, I'm Megan Wasson. I'm a fellow third-year medical student here at Emory and event coordinator for Wiser. Today, we're honored to have Dr. Jennifer Gross with us on the podcast. Dr. Gross is currently an assistant professor in the Division of Head and Neck Surgery at Emory University. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Gross.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
So just to get us started, would you mind to tell us just a little bit about yourself?
I am a head and neck surgeon at Emory, mostly Midtown and Winship, which means that I do both ablative and reconstructive surgery on patients who have benign and malignant tumors of the head and neck. I have been at Emory ever since I graduated from fellowship in 2020. I am from the Atlanta area. My whole family is here. And I went to college at WashU in St. Louis. I came back here for medical school. So just like you all, I went to Emory Med School and loved it. Then I went back to WashU for residency. And then I did a year of head and neck surgery fellowship at University of Miami, and now I'm here. And I know it's a little confusing. I did a residency in, the specialty is called otolaryngology dash head and neck surgery. And, you know, people who aren't in medicine call it ENT, but there are multiple subspecialties, and one of them is head and neck surgery, which is kind of what I described.
Thank you. And could you talk about what drew you to medicine and what made you choose ENT as a specialty?
So I grew up in a medical household, actually. My dad is a plastic surgeon through general surgery. And then my mom is a nurse and was his first assist. And they had a practice together. Every day coming home, they would talk about medicine. My sister and I would go on rounds with him. We sometimes worked at the office, so we were very much a part of that world, and it felt very familiar and comfortable. I didn't really think that I was going to go into medicine, though, and I pursued other interests in high school and college, and I was actually even in the business school for a short period of time. But I eventually obviously came back to it in college. It just seemed like such a wonderful opportunity to be able to both help people, also be challenged intellectually. And I was ultimately pretty familiar with the process. So I ended up switching back into pre-medical studies and kind of went from there. Why did I choose ENT? So I actually went through a variety of different phases of what specialty I was going to pick. My favorite class in college was actually immunology. So I was thinking, oh, I'll be an immunologist, but that didn't really seem practical at the time. And it wasn't really what I thought it was going to be. And then once we started preclinical, I thought, oh, hemonc sounded really interesting. And again, I think that those are kind of in the same realm of academic study. So I started shadowing someone in hemonc, and it was just honestly too devastating for me. I felt like the patients were very sick, and not only from their cancer, but also from their treatment. And it was very hard for me to emotionally deal with that. So then I thought, okay, I want to be involved in something that's maybe has a little bit more immediate positive impact on a patient. And what's better to do that than surgery, where you can cure someone's cancer in one day? And then I stumbled upon gyn-onc, loved it, did not like OB. No offense. And then we had those 2-week clerkships. We had like an ENT one. And I thought, huh, this is kind of interesting. And so I just contacted faculty members and residents to try and shadow them more. And I realized that I really loved the idea of being able to treat one part of the body completely, whether it be medically or surgically. And so a patient comes in and you are kind of the expert in that anatomic region of the body. So you can kind of determine with the diagnosis and the treatment. In my mind, a lot of other surgical specialties, they get the referrals from the medical kind of analog of that, GI and general surgery, for example. But ENT, they kind of manage everything. In addition to the fact that in anatomy lab, I thought the facial anatomy was definitely the most interesting. It seemed the most complex too. So that's what kind of drew me to it.
I would certainly agree based on my experience in the anatomy lab that the facial anatomy was the most complex. Head and
Yes,
neck
yes.
was quite complex.
We're constantly learning, even though I've been in practice for, a handful of years and in training for even more years. Some of these parts of the head and neck anatomy, you don't actually see in real life that frequently. So you'll see it in a cadaver and you'll see it in a textbook, but only after you've seen it in real life a few times is it really cement in your memory. And I'm still having that experience now, so it's definitely challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. And you just going back a little bit, you mentioned that one of the things that drew you to head and neck and ENT was being an expert in one anatomic region, which, based on my experience, just rotating 2 weeks on the service, I thought that that was certainly true. But I thought that the facet of head and neck surgery that I wasn't quite aware of was how extensively you did operate in other areas of the body for flap reconstructions. So I'm
Yeah.
wondering if you could talk a little bit about that aspect of your work with regards to kind of this perception of ENT being kind of localized to the head and neck, but in reality, you are working in quite a large area of the body.
Yeah, head and neck surgical oncology, the subspecialty that I'm in, is fairly unique, both I think in other surgical specialties and also within, ENT. We, remove tumors kind of from the clavicle up, excluding the brain. We'll do skull base, and then, the neurosurgery team will work with us and remove anything that's kind of beyond the skull base, intracranial. But then we also do a wide variety of reconstructions from all over the body. And that isn't how the specialty started out, but it's kind of become what it is now. And when you are going to a head and neck surgery fellowship, there are only a handful that are still ablative only. So almost all of them will have this reconstructive part of it as well. And so these kind of free flaps, which I'll get into a little bit, used to be done by general plastics, but now I think a lion's share of it are done by head and neck surgeons, and it's because we have the patients too. The majority of our free flaps, our soft tissue free flap reconstruction, are the radial forearm, the anterolateral thigh. The bony workhorse reconstruction options are the fibula free flap, the osteocutaneous radial forearm free flap, and the scapula free flap. So there's some people who still do rectus muscle flaps, that crest, jejunal. These are a little more rare. Some of my colleagues also do medial sural flaps and lateral arm flaps. So we kind of go all over the body, and it's really interesting. Nobody knows what we do.
Yeah.
So in order to go into this specialty, you can't have an ego, which I think is interesting. If you meet people in our specialty and just ENT in general, no one is going into it for the prestige because, you'll say, "Oh, I'm an ENT," and they'll say, "Oh, do you ride in an ambulance?" or, various questions like that. So nobody really knows. It doesn't have the same, appeal as if you say you're a neurosurgeon or you're a whatever surgeon. And so I think the people are very nice, very welcoming. And in terms of the subspecialty that I do, head and neck surgery, there are about 330 practicing head and neck surgeons in the United States. So not very many of us. You know, that's about like one per million people, just because there are only so many tumors out there to be removed. But yeah, that's why no one knows what we do. It's very cool though.
It is very cool. And I guess what I want to know is, you said there are only 330 maybe-ish head and neck surgeons. I'm sure less than half of them are women, probably. So how do you navigate that space as a woman in a very small niche field that's very high intensity?
I think probably similar to other surgical fields, the number of women graduating from the fellowship has increased a lot in the past, 10, 20 years. I think number of practicing head and neck surgeons is probably still about 20% or maybe less, but it used to be much, much less. So I feel very fortunate to be now in a field that is much more accommodating, understanding of the challenges of being a woman in the workplace, of, right when you start your career is right when we kind of tend to go through family planning. And especially at Emory, I feel extremely lucky to have such understanding colleagues. And it's been great. I think the field has attracted more women recently just because there are more specialists in the field. You know, even just 10 years ago, the number of practicing head and neck surgeons was significantly lower. And so the volume per surgeon was much, much higher. The quality of life was worse. The hours were worse. As we have more of us in the field, there is much more ability to have that quote work-life balance that we all, I guess, strive for. And also gotten much more efficient at just the surgical techniques. You know, when we started with reconstructive surgery, these flaps were taking 24 hours. This is even like 20, or so years ago. Now we are realizing through trial and error as a specialty that some of these techniques that we were doing aren't necessary. We don't need to be maybe as cautious about some things. And so, as a specialty, we've kind of grown and learned. And now we can do free flaps in 4 to 5 hours. So that also is a huge benefit to what you're talking about. And then, there's an increase in female leaders in the field, which just kind of comes with time. So I think we're on the right track, and I feel just fortunate to be a head and neck surgeon at this time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it sounds, you kind of touched on this a little bit, but it sounds like in the past, and maybe this is improving a little bit, but there's potentially been some barriers to women being in this field. I'm wondering, and I think you kind of discussed a little bit work-life balance. I'm wondering if maybe family is a component of or a potential barrier that some women in this field face with regards to some of the surgeries that you do and the length of surgeries and things of that nature.
Absolutely. I will tell you that I graduated fellowship in 2020, and at that time I knew one attending, female attending, who did reconstructive head neck surgery. So, all of this is fairly recent. In my class, which was a 2020 fellow class, I think over 40% of us were women. So it's kind of a very recent trend. And of course, finding women in academics is also less frequent than in private practice. But in reference to your question on family planning, I mean, when you're going through so much training, similar to any surgical field, oftentimes your plan to start a family is pushed later and later. And I know that I'm sure you guys have read the articles about how that has impacted fertility for women, especially female surgeons. So it's very scary, but it logistically, at least for me and a lot of my co-residents and friends, it would have been impossible to do it during training. And so this was kind of the only real option for us. And once you reach the age of your mid-30s and you're trying to start a family, it's now corresponding with you're starting a new job. You want to be available. You want to be doing the harder cases. At least I did. You're moving somewhere new. And you have this increased chance of infertility that you're dealing with. I think I have been extremely fortunate and haven't had that problem. I have a 1.5-year-old. And so I, after 1 year of working at Emory, I thought, okay, I feel like I'm in a good place. And now I can start to think about having my own family. And I'm also 6.5 months pregnant currently. So
Congratulations.
thanks. You can't tell up here, but you know, I just hear what everyone else is going through and having to go through IVF or having miscarriages. And you know, the only thing I can say is make sure that you are trying to find an environment that is understanding of needing to take breaks, needing to sit down. Always just put your own health in, put your own health first. Because my mantra was, you know, I went through all of this training and stress up until what I was 32 or three. And when I finished fellowship, I said, you know, now I get to start my own life on my own terms. I'm going to put my quality of life first. I'm going to put my preferences and my family first. And that might not be what everyone else chooses, but I was just tired of, you know, opening up an envelope and seeing where I was going to live for 5 years. And I think that that kind of mindset and trying to put yourself and your family first and being adaptable to what's available out there, maybe not setting your sights on one specific job or one specific location and just being open, I think will allow you to put those things first.
I think it's crazy impressive that you have a 1.5-year-old, you're pregnant now, and your husband is also in medicine. I was wondering if you could talk about how, your guys's family kind of looks, given that you guys are both probably super busy.
Yeah, we actually met in college. We were lab partners. So we were dissecting like dogfish and cats. And through a series of events, I was very late to class and there was only one seat left in the classroom. My friend told me he was going to save me a seat. He didn't. So then I was stuck next to this stranger and it was him.
That's crazy.
So we became lab partners senior year of college, and then we had to make decisions together very quickly because, as you know, you're kind of on the medicine train. Once you get on, it's hard to get off. So we then applied to be at the NIH together for a year off, and then we went to med school together, and then couples matched to WashU, spent a year of fellowship apart. He was in Utah, I was in Miami. And then he does ortho spine at a private hospital in the Atlanta area. And we got really lucky again. We just decided we wanted to come to Atlanta because most of our family is here. So he actually got his job first. He found a practice that he really loved. And then, kind of like what I was alluding to, I know that not everyone is going to have this type of outlook, but I said, you know, I'm going to do whatever I need to do to be with him. So I just applied to kind of all potential opportunities in the city of Atlanta, private practice, hospital-based, academics. You know, my first choice was always Emory, but I wasn't sure if they'd have a little, you know, none of these places were posting anything. So I was just thinking, you know, I want to be there. I'll make it work. I have good training. This doesn't have to be my forever job, but I just need to get to Atlanta and do something marginally related to what I've been trained in. And, somehow I got this awesome job that's the best. But yes, we are very busy. When you have such a time-intensive career and your partner does as well, you need all the help you can get. Luckily, my parents are here. I cannot emphasize how much that has impacted our lives in a positive way. And I know that not everyone has that opportunity. But I didn't really understand that, of course, until I had a child. And that we also have a full-time nanny. So she is there when my mom, when my parents aren't there. And then my sister's here too, and sometimes she'll drop in and help. So it really does take multiple people to assist us and our professional and personal endeavors.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear. Thank you so much for sharing about all of that. I know Shannon and I are kind of, in a crossroads point in our lives, and it sounds like you were very intentional in terms of making sure that the plan that you wanted was executed. And it's really interesting to hear about some of the things that you did to kind of implement and set yourself up for that final destination. Something that you mentioned, though, while we were just chatting was, work-life balance. And I think one of the components of work that I often forget, especially at Emory, is how big a part research can be. And you had mentioned this as well, like previously working at the NIH. And I think I saw somewhere that you have experience working with the CDC in Beijing. I'm wondering if you can talk about that research component of the work-life balance that everybody's constantly trying to figure out.
That definitely throws a wrench in it because a lot of research is after hours. When you have a certain amount of academic time, that is usually not entirely accurate because you're writing things at night or you're reviewing things on the weekend. But I think I've just, ever since undergrad, I've just been exposed to it, and it's just has made sense to be a part of my medical journey and understanding and contribution. So I haven't really questioned it, whether I want it to be part of my career. It just always has been. I only do kind of clinical research, but at Emory, as faculty members in my department, we get one academic day per week. So that's about 20% time, which is fantastic. So we can use that time to do some research. Of course, that time often gets filled with, meetings or like today, or catching up on clinical work, patient care, those kinds of things. But you again have to be fairly intentional. Depending on how interested you are in making research a part of your career, you just want to make sure that you pick a place that kind of supports that. At Emory, we don't really have a benchmark that we have to reach. It's more based on your clinical interest. So it's very flexible.
Personally, I was just also super curious on your experience working in Beijing versus here. Do you think you could talk a little bit more about that too?
So I was only there for half a year, my year between college and medical school. I had one of those post-bac IRTA research fellowships at the NIH, which is actually a year-long fellowship, but I cut it short after half a year because I wanted to go to China. I minored in Chinese. My mom's family is from Hong Kong. So I had spent some time in China with a semester abroad, and I was really interested in public health. And so I cold called the Beijing CDC. And I think that that's actually a common theme that I do recommend. Kind of getting to where I've gotten every step of the way was because I shamelessly contacted that organization, including my current job. But I went there and they were very happy to have me. It was a very disorganized internship because it wasn't official, you know. They said, "Oh, we'd be happy to have you come here and assist with us on our public health visits," where they were essentially going to public service kind of like spas and seeing if they were performing under appropriate health code. And so I was helping with that. And I will tell you, there was a lot of difference in the two systems. I can't get into it. It would take too long, but it was definitely interesting to see how an organization like this performs in an autocratic nation. They are able to get things done much, much more rapidly. For example, I wrote an article, I was there, called or discussing the implementation of the national healthcare system in China, which they did in 5 years, meaning they started, there was absolutely no national healthcare. And in a country of over a billion people, you know, 750 million of them living in rural China. And they were able to get everyone under this system with infrastructure, you know, their version of insurance in 5 years, which is like absolutely mind-blowing
Crazy. Yeah.
compared to our legislative hurdles. So I think there's definitely something to learn from that. And then I did some other assistance with helping them with their English translation of scientific journal articles, because English is still the major scientific language. But it was definitely a transformative experience.
Very cool. Yeah, thank you. But just sort of, summarizing what you've said so far, it seems like you got to know what you want, and you also have to be able to kind of, put it, just kind of go for what you want and know what you want, including cold calling
Yeah. You know, everyone has been very receptive every step of the way. You know, if you are pleasant, you know, people seem to respond to enthusiastic emails or calls from young people. So I do recommend it. And I also think part of that, though, is being adaptable. And even though, you know, you might have in your mind what you want to do and you go for it, you have to be able to adapt and adjust your expectations.
What great life advice. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah. I know we're heading towards the end of our time. We always really like to ask our guests about some fun facts about themselves. And so I'm wondering if you would share any hobbies or interests that you have outside of medicine. And I'm particularly interested because I've heard rumor that you might be an avid runner.
Oh, you know, last week in the OR, the residents and I were talking about if someone asks you a fun fact about yourself, what would it be? I love scuba diving. And I used to be a volunteer scuba diver at the Georgia Aquarium. Highly
Oh, that's
recommend.
so cool.
Yeah.
How did you get involved in that?
Well, I love the water. And we don't have any water. So, actually, in medical school, I applied to be a volunteer there so that I could get into those tanks because it was like a 10-minute drive from where I lived. And it was, you know, the closest thing I had to the ocean. So, I became a volunteer. I first volunteered at the front of the house because you need a certain number of hours before you can become a back of the house volunteer. So I was giving tours in Ocean Voyager. And then with the scuba diving, I would just help with cleaning a few of the tanks. So, like the beluga tank, the wall of fish, Ocean Voyager. Yeah, it was fun. I would love to do it again, but I think that maybe it's too popular now. But oh, you asked about running. Yeah. But yes, running is a form of meditation. It is a great way to get outside and clear your head. And I can't wait to get back to it. It's a lot harder when pregnant.
Understandable.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the last question that we have time for, and we ask this up to all of our guests, is what song would you add to our Wiser OR playlist?
Oh, so I am probably, I'm a stickler in the OR for the music. I have veto rights. So if someone puts something on that I hate, I get to veto. And I always tell them you can play anything but today's top hits. But generally, I think if you ask the residents, they know I like listening to electronic music. And I think that Odessa is a version of electronic music that is melodic and also I think other people can get behind. It's not too scary. I'd probably recommend an Odessa song.
Okay, cool.
Well, Dr. Gross, thank you so much for joining us today for another episode of Wiser. We loved hearing about your life and your career, and we're so excited for our listeners to get to know you as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Wiser. If you liked this episode, please rate and leave a review as it helps others find the show. You can also share it with friends and family. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Wiser Podcast for updates.